You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, a guest makes the case against sugar and says it could be the main culprit in a wide variety of health conditions that take years off of our lives.
First, our next guest says we're living in dangerous times. Times, he says, when people have access to more information than ever before, but are more resistant than ever before to learning anything.
He calls it the death of expertise. That's the title of Tom Nichols' new book, which looks at why today's glut of knowledge has produced what he calls an army of ill-informed and angry citizens instead of a well-educated public interested in informed debate about the issues.
Tom Nichols joins us now. He's professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and is an adjunct professor at the Harvard Extension School. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with your words. You say, never have so many people had so much access to so much knowledge and yet have been so resistant to learning anything. Where do you see that playing out in American culture today?
Well, it plays out everywhere in the way Americans react to science, in the way that Americans approach their elections, in a way that they inform themselves about daily events. There's plenty of information, but people essentially cherry-pick it to find things they already agree with, and they strongly reject anything that makes them uncomfortable or that clashes with their previously held beliefs.
Well, what do you think is at stake as a society, as a democracy, when we stop respecting the experts?
Well, as I say at the end of the book, and I hate to ever be so pessimistic about it, but the division between experts and lay people, between the people who have to help craft policy and the voters, if that distance gets too wide, the foundations of our republic are in danger, because people will get to the point where they simply decide they don't trust anybody and anything. And ironically, what that leads to is a further politicization of knowledge, because instead of being able to present the public with alternatives and for a rational and reasoned debate, what you'll get are people deciding to take sides, and that'll include the experts as well as the elected representatives. And I think that's an important part of this as well, that people have now confused experts with being decision makers. And those aren't usually the same people. Experts can only advise, but the American people and their elected officials are the ones that actually have to make informed choices. And when that breaks down, we're headed someplace that we don't want to be, I think.
Now, your book was being finished up during the 2016 presidential election, and since then we've seen a war over facts and fake news. We have different factions disagreeing about what's a fact and what's an alternative fact, what's real news and what's fake news. How does that affect how well-informed the public can be?
Well, it's interesting because I actually didn't write the book about the election. I started the book some years ago, and as I should also point out that my views here are my own. I don't represent the Navy or the War College. I actually started writing this because of what I saw as a larger social trend. During the election, it got completely out of control, I think, with the charges about fake news and, lying media. And I think that that's a really unhealthy situation, because the fact of the matter is, to be an informed voter, you do have to accept that some things are true and some things are false, that some things are knowable, and that you actually can make reasoned choices rather than simply making voting as an emotional reaction. And I think that's been lost in the last few elections, but it reached a crescendo with this one. So I think it dovetailed into everything I was warning about in the book, and I'm not sure we're past that yet.
And playing off of what you were just talking about there, I mean, you also write about how there's this urge, you say, for people to consider their own opinions on par with the experts. But there's that, but there's also an animosity that seems to go along with that now, an animosity for expertise. Do you see that as something that's been a sea change?
Yes, and it's part of what I think is an unhealthy populism that's always been there in the American spirit. But that we've always tempered with, I think, a very, very prudent approach to governing a republic. The tension and the animosity, I think, has grown partly because in a very complicated, very technologically advanced, very diplomatically and politically complicated world, people resent the experts because they have to rely on them. And Richard Hofstadter wrote about this nearly 60 years ago, and I don't think it's gotten any better since, that people resent experts because deep down they know they have no choice but to rely on them. But there's also a way in which experts, I think, have just been scapegoated now as the go-to explanation for anything that's happening in the world that people don't like. And I think that lets the voters off the hook for their own choices. And I think when the voters start saying they're not responsible and that clearly these are just experts making decisions, they're abdicating their own role in the process, and that's very dangerous for democracy.
Well, you're a professor, and you write about how you've seen that play out directed at you and maybe other academics. Are there other fields like that that you think are being maybe scapegoated right now?
Doctors, lawyers, engineers, you name it. People, I think, have a sense, and this is almost a throwback to where we were sometime in the 1940s or 1950s or perhaps even before, when people assumed that professionals were lazy and manipulative and charlatans and all of the other things that we're hearing being thrown out now that, again, have been partly mobilized because of our very partisan election, the political process in 2015 and 2016. Professors, of course, always take it in the neck because, you know, nobody likes professors. That's always been a term that people both respect and despise at the same time. So as I say in the book, you know, if you don't like the criticism aimed at professors, you shouldn't be in the business. But I think now it has spilled over onto other professions and in a way that is really unhealthy.
We're talking with Tom Nichols right now. His new book is called The Death of Expertise. And, Tom, you write about in 2014 how the Washington Post polled people about whether or not the U.S. should engage in military intervention in Ukraine. And, you know, this was after the 2014 Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it turned out that the less people knew about that subject, the more likely they were to be really robust about wanting military intervention. What do you make of that?
That's a terrifying result. It's one of the reasons I led the book with it, because I was aghast at reading that poll. And it wasn't just one poll. There are several times when the public's been asked its opinion about things. One of my favorite polling tricks is to ask people what they think about a particular policy, and they'll tell you that they think it's a great policy if they think it's associated with a politician they already like, that they take their cues that way rather than look at the policy itself, because it's become a kind of a team sport in that way. I think the bigger problem is that people, even when they don't know things, that doesn't prohibit them or inhibit them, rather, I should say, from expressing really strong opinions about it. You know, some of the funniest reviews or comments I've gotten on the book on social media, people have tweeted at me to say, well, I haven't read your book, but I think it's wrong. and that's kind of how they are about public policy. Well, I don't really know where Ukraine is, but I have a really strong opinion about what we should do there. In the book, I point out that there was a poll taken about whether we should bomb Agrippa. And Republicans and Democrats both expressed really strong opinions, some for, some against. But, of course, these people who answered the poll didn't understand that Agrippa it's the cartoon country in Aladdin. People were expressing really strong views about whether or not to bomb a cartoon. You can't run a democracy that way. You cannot have a healthy, informed public debate with people who have strong opinions about whether or not you should bomb fictional places. And that really worries me. That's part of what motivated me to write the book.
I want to talk about where you were during the recent election. You say your book was almost finished. You'd written it beforehand. But during the election, you were active as a conservative who didn't support Donald Trump. You were maybe the East Coast corollary to Charlie Sykes here in Wisconsin. You were a never-Trumper. And since then, we've seen Donald Trump's first weeks in office. What is your take on those first few weeks?
It's interesting because the president ran on a campaign of saying, you know, the experts don't matter, you know, kind of good gut common sense and business acumen can rule the day. I think, and I'm hoping, and I'm praying that what the president is finding now is that experts do matter. And you are seeing people like H.R. McMaster and James Mattis and other appointees coming in who actually know something about the subject themselves. So I think, again, this is a common thing in American populism, that you run during an election and you say, you know, nobody in Washington knows anything. We don't need educated experts. We don't need people with long experience in these matters. And then you actually approach governing and realize how monstrously complicated it is to run a superpower of 310 million people, and then you reach out for experts. So I'm hoping that the president is reaching out to those experts in a way that I thought he wouldn't during the campaign, but I still think, I guess that remains to be seen. I see some signs for hope, but I still worry about that strong populist strain that says that you don't need to ask people who know anything about anything.
And Tom, just briefly before I let you go, you have a huge Twitter following, and people seem to either really enjoy yelling at you or they go to you to be kind of calmed down, to be talked off the ledge. What is it like being that sort of unofficial calming glass of warm milk for people who are going through these extremes of political anxiety?
Well, it's pretty difficult because, again, I think part of the job of an expert, as I say in the book, you know, the client for an expert is society. Whether we're teachers or doctors or lawyers or engineers, our client is our society overall. And so I think it's my responsibility to, you know, answer people's questions as honestly as I can. And sometimes that means telling them things they don't want to hear. And I suppose the most distressing part of it is when someone says, wow, I thought you were really, you know, on my side here. Well, no, I'm not on your side. I'm on the side of the truth. And sometimes that'll work, you know, in a way that you'll like, and sometimes it'll be something you don't like. And that's a very difficult place to be because I think experts have an obligation to tell the truth even when the public doesn't want to hear it. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters.
Coming up, our guest lays out the case against sugar. Stay with us here on Central Time. There's more scientific evidence than ever these days that sugar is bad for us. Research has linked excess sugar consumption to obesity and a handful of chronic diseases, and some have suggested that sugar can even be physically addictive, much like tobacco or even hard drugs.
But just how did sugar become such a big part of our diets? Our next guest has written a comprehensive account of America's relationship with sugar, as well as how the substance flew under the radar for many years. He also makes the case that it may be time to start considering sugar as a drug rather than a food.
Gary Taubes joins us now. He's a science and health journalist and the co-founder of the Nutrition Science Initiative. He's written three books. His latest is called The Case Against Sugar. Gary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Is it time to start rethinking sugar, not as a benign food additive, but as a harmful substance that needs more regulation?
Yeah, if ever there was a better late than never, this was the time. The argument I make in this book is that for a variety of reasons. I'm still trying to get over, by the way, the irony of coming after, you know, Tom Nichols discussing the death of expertise. So I'm about to explain why I think the experts were wrong for 100 years on sugar. We had embraced a series of beliefs about how diet affects our health. The last 50 years being that we should really worry about the fat in our diet, and therefore any food that's somehow low in fat, even, you know, yogurt, you take the fat out, you put sugar in, or high fructose corn syrup so that it's tasty and you could advertise it as a heart healthy diet food. And we just ignored the evidence against sugar throughout this period. The worst we ever said about it is it's the empty calories that you might consume in excess. And it just ignores an awful lot of kind of physiological reality about how this substance, sugar, affects our health.
Gary, you do point out when you go through the history of how we've treated sugar, there were experts along the way who were sounding the alarm about sugar 100 years ago, even longer. Why did they get drowned out? And we pointed over the years toward other culprits when we look at unhealthy eating, obesity, chronic health conditions.
What we're trying to explain here and what you're describing is that when cultures, populations transition to Western diets, when they go from whatever they were eating, their traditional diets, to Western diets and lifestyles, when they become more affluent, when populations become urbanized, they experience these epidemics of obesity and diabetes. And diabetes, is the numbers are particularly startling because you go, for instance, in the U.S. in the late 19th century, say the decade after the Civil War, you could go to major hospitals in major American cities like Philadelphia or Boston, and they could go an entire year without seeing a case of diabetes diagnosed. And today, 1 in 11 Americans is diabetic, and this is just a shocking transition. And as researchers, as clinicians, public health authorities started to recognize this diabetes epidemic in the works in the U.S. or Europe in the 1920s, there was authorities saying, well, you know, one of the things that has changed dramatically is how much sugar we're consuming, and diabetes is a disorder of carbohydrate intolerance. You're either secreting too much insulin or not enough insulin to deal with the carbohydrates in the diet. Sugar's a carbohydrate, maybe sugar's the problem. And at first in the 1920s, we sort of swept that argument away based on, well, a very influential physician in Boston named Elliot Joslin, who had become the most famous diabetes specialist of the 20th century and just didn't really understand his biochemistry, so he didn't realize that sugar was fundamentally different from other carbohydrates like rice. And then in the 1960s, when very influential British and American nutritionists started suggesting that sugar again was an obvious culprit for diabetes and might cause heart disease as well, we were obsessively focusing on the fat in the diet. And despite the fact that this idea that dietary fat is a cause of heart disease was never confirmed in experimental trials, we put in motion extraordinary public health efforts to get us all to eat the sort of low-fat diet that we've now grown up on. So it's just, I don't know how else to put it, uninformed experts pushing the wrong ideas and ignoring the obvious for a century.
Talking to Gary Taubes, author of the new book, The Case Against Sugar. Gary, lay out what we know now about the impact of sugar, not just on diabetes, on obesity, heart conditions, the whole gamut. What do we know more or less for certain about the impact of sugar?
Well, what we know for certain, yeah, my book is A Case Against Sugar, and as I say in the author's note, it's the prosecution's
right.
argument, because there's not a lot we know for certain. We could say what's highly likely or what's more or less likely. So when we're talking about sugars, and this has been one of the areas of confusion for a century, the sugar, the beet or cane sugar, high fructose corn syrup, these are nutrients that are half fructose. And so half of these molecules are glucose, which is the stuff of the carbohydrate that's in all starches and that we digest. We absorb it into our bloodstream. It raises blood sugar. Our physicians also often refer to blood sugar as blood glucose. And that's metabolized by every cell in the body for all intents and purposes. But half of these compounds are fructose. Fructose is the sweetest carb. It's what makes sugar sweet. And it happens to be metabolized almost exclusively in the liver. And what's particularly damning in this case is that type 2 diabetes is a disorder of insulin resistance. Not having a deficiency of the hormone insulin as in type 1 diabetes, the kind that usually is diagnosed in children, but it's having too much insulin in your system. And insulin resistance is believed to begin in the liver with liver insulin resistance, and it's believed by many researchers to begin with excess fat accumulation in liver cells. And we know that the fructose component of sugar, when you, in effect, dump it on the liver in high doses, the liver will convert it to fat. So then we have all these diseases that associate with insulin resistance. So not just obesity and type 2 diabetes is a disease of insulin resistance, but there's a new disorder called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is epidemic in America today, and 30 years ago, if you were diagnosed with liver disease and you told your doctor that you didn't drink, if you were diagnosed with fatty liver and you told your doctor you didn't drink, your doctor would assume that you were lying to them and that only alcohol consumption caused fatty liver. Then fatty liver started showing up in children who clearly didn't drink, and the obvious culprit there, once again, is sugar consumption and sugary beverages. Obesity and diabetes are associated with heart disease, with excess risk of stroke, cerebrovascular disease, with cancer, and with Alzheimer's. And all these diseases are intimately related, once again, to this condition called insulin resistance. And like I said, insulin resistance, if you had to pick a culprit, a single prime suspect, it would clearly be our sugar consumption. And if sugar causes insulin resistance, then it either causes or at least increases our risk of all these other diseases.
Gary, just a few moments left. As the prosecutor in the case against sugar, what do we need to change? What has to happen with sugar?
Well, you know, if we go back to the early 19th century in the U.S. Diabetes and obesity were rare disorders, or you go back even, say, 50 years in Asia when diabetes and obesity were very rare disorders, sugar consumption was maybe one-tenth what it is today. Sugar and sweets were luxuries. They weren't something you consumed from the moment you woke up in your morning glass of orange juice or in the sugar you put in your coffee and tea. To the moment you went to sleep after dessert, they were something you consumed, you know, a couple times a week as a treat. I don't know if we can ever get back to that. Clearly, sugar has saturated our lives, and it's how we communicate love and happiness and joy, everything that Coca-Cola and PepsiCo commercials communicate on TV during sporting events.
And we'll leave it there. Out of time, Gary Taubes, thanks for joining us. Gary Taubes' new book, he's a health journalist. He wrote the book, The Case Against Sugar.
Coming up, a legal ethics expert talks about calls for U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to resign. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up to 9 after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Included in tonight's stories, a blind man goes on an adventure to test his senses, a woman navigates the do's and don'ts of widowhood, and a humanitarian rescue worker is forced to decide whether he'll break the rules to save more lives. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from any investigation into possible Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. He did this after controversy emerged over his contacts with a Russian ambassador last year during the campaign. Democrats are calling for him to resign. Democrats and some Republicans had been calling out on him to recuse himself from those investigations. His office confirmed that he spoke to the Russian ambassador to the United States last year, even though he told senators during his January confirmation hearing that he didn't talk to Russia during the presidential campaign.
If there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
A spokesperson for Jeff Sessions told the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post that he spoke to the Russian ambassador twice last year before the presidential election, once during the Republican National Convention and later from his Senate office.
Rebecca Roife joins us now to look at this issue from an ethics perspective. She's a professor of law at the New York Law School. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, you've looked at prosecutors and when they can recuse themselves. Before we get into the specifics of this case, what are the things that someone should consider when deciding whether or not to recuse themselves from a case that they're somehow involved in?
Well, any prosecutor is expected to be disinterested and any prosecutor should recuse themselves whenever they think they have a personal connection to the matter that makes it difficult for them to act in that kind of impartial way that's required of prosecutors. This is kind of a special case, obviously, because the Attorney General is so close to the White House, and there's so many political considerations. One thing we know about any prosecution is it should never be influenced by any kind of political or partisan concern. So when you decide when and whether to prosecute an individual, it shouldn't be a political determination. And there are a series of laws, ethical rules, and kind of structural, sort of almost historical norms that protect that. So that's what we're talking about here with Jeff Sessions. It's really about preserving prosecutorial disinterestedness.
Well, let's give a listen now to Attorney General Sessions saying that he was going to recuse himself from investigations involving Russia's potential influence in the American election.
Mm-hmm. My staff recommended recusal. They said that since I had involvement with the campaign, I should not be involved in any campaign investigation. I have studied the rules and considered their comments and evaluation. I believe those recommendations are right and just. Therefore, I have recused myself in the matters that deal with the Trump campaign.
So from those comments, that really isn't even taking into consideration the kind of the headlines today about him having met with the Russian ambassador and allegations
right.
that there was perjury. He's saying, and this is what some people were saying even before these allegations,
yeah.
he was involved with the campaign, therefore he should step aside from the investigation.
I mean, that's right. So the Department of Justice regulation on this, there used to be a statute, the Ethics in Government Act in 1978, which came right after the Whitewater scandal. But after that law was allowed to sunset, Department of Justice put in these regulations, and that regulation says that if someone has a personal or political relationship with any person or organization that's involved in the conduct that's subject to the investigation, then that person should recuse. So he's almost quoting that language. And a lot of critics had said way before this information came out that just because of his connection to President Trump and his clear involvement in the campaign, that he should have recused himself back then. And it's only after these recent revelations about his contact with the Russian ambassador that the Republican senators and congressmen really jumped on board. And I think that's the pressure that pushed him to say what he said this afternoon.
Things are a bit weird, though. I mean, this will go to a Justice Department employee who had been there before the Trump administration, but they're still part of the executive branch now. Is there something about people being part of this administration, whether a direct appointee of the new president or not, that makes it a bit awkward to be investigating this case?
I think it makes it completely awkward, and that's why in the past there has been no question when there's an investigation that involves officials all the way up to the president that the a special prosecutor is appointed, and I think that's what should happen here.
Do you think that will happen, and who would have to take the initiative to appoint that special prosecutor?
Well, the initiative is generally taken by the Attorney General, or here the Acting Attorney General, to do so. I mean, there can certainly be Congress can certainly put pressure on the White House to do that, but that's the way it would happen. Do I think it's going to happen? From the way things are going, honestly, it looks like what happens is when the political pressure is extreme enough, that's when the administration acts. So unless we get to that point, no, I think that they won't.
Talking to Rebecca Roife from the New York Law School, looking at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, our revelations today about conversations he'd had with the Russian ambassador during the presidential campaign, apparently conflicting with statements he'd made during his Senate confirmation hearings. Rebecca, people are throwing the word perjury around. It's a serious accusation. What do you make of that potential charge here? Are his statements serious enough and contradictory enough to warrant a charge of perjury?
You know, I don't think so. Federal perjury law makes it such that there has to be a very clear lie, you know, just to put it bluntly. The person has to clearly have been backed into a corner where they say something explicitly untrue. And here, Senator Sessions has already offered an excuse, whether you believe that excuse or not, about how he understood the question or what he understood the question to mean. And I think that'll make a perjury prosecution impossible. There are, there are certain consequences that come from misleading Congress, but that's not perjury.
So there's wiggle room here, clearly, for a potential perjury investigation.
Right. He claims that he was acting as in his capacity as the part of the Senate and not as part of the campaign when he met with the ambassador, and that he thought the question had to do with the campaign. Now, when you read the question, it's actually very odd because nobody asked him that question. Senator Franken didn't say, did you meet with any representatives of the Russian government? So it's very odd that he volunteered that information at that point.
And you said, short of perjury, there might be lesser consequences to misleading the Senate in this case. What would those be?
Well, I mean, I don't really know. I know that, there is some historical precedent for this. Nixon's Attorney General, Richard Kleindienst, he was actually brought up on indicted for perjury for lying to Congress. And then he ultimately pled to a misdemeanor of misleading Congress. And, I haven't looked up this law to see exactly what would be involved and whether it's still on the books, but maybe there could be something like that. I just don't think that there's a perjury charge that could actually go forward in this case.
On the wider issues of Russian influence on the American election and the different kinds of investigations that can go on, we mentioned something from the Attorney General's office, an independent prosecutor looking into this. People also talked about various kinds of congressional investigations into this. What kind of options do you see out there?
Yes, of course, there could be a congressional investigation. The best kind, of course, would be a bipartisan congressional investigation. That could happen. At this point, it's hard to see exactly what's gonna happen. I think that the recent events have changed the landscape a little bit, but you know how things can move so quickly. It's not clear that this is giving anybody enough political incentive to actually start some kind of investigation.
We're talking to Rebecca Roifey from the New York Law School about calls from congressional lawmakers for U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, some calling him to resign, and he has just announced that he's recusing himself from investigations into Russian influence in U.S. politics and last year's presidential campaign in particular.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Do you think Jeff Sessions should resign? Are you happy that he recused himself? What would you like to see happen with an investigation into Russian interference with the 2016 presidential election? You can call in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with Rebecca Roifey from the New York Law School about criticism of U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions over his meetings with the Russian ambassador last year, which he declined to mention in his confirmation hearings in January.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of all this? Are you happy with the Attorney General's decision to recuse himself from federal investigations into possible Russian interference in the U.S. elections last year? What do you think of calls from some critics, mainly Democrats, saying that he should resign because he had misled the Senate? Do you agree or disagree with those calls? Do you have questions for a guest about what's going on here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Jim on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think there's little reason to believe that he was attempting to be misleading. If they wanted to find somebody who committed perjury, they should not have to look very far. James Clapper obviously committed perjury and was not pursued for it. I think maybe they should investigate the people who are saying that 17 intelligence agencies agreed that there was interaction with the Russian intelligence. because that's implying that the DEA and the Coast Guard were also investigating this and agreed with those conclusions.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Rebecca, he's not too worried about these allegations. And it seems like there's a partisan reaction to a lot of this. Does that get in the way of actually trying to solve this in accordance with the law?
I think that things are so charged now that inevitably it does. From my perspective, it should be important for both Democrats and Republicans to make sure that any investigation has no appearance of impropriety. So if there's no question about this, if this is all made up, if there's no problem with the campaign and its contact with Russia, then what would be wrong with having a special bipartisan committee of Congress or having a special prosecutor? It seems like there's no cost to Republicans in that, and there's so much to gain in terms of legitimacy of the system, especially in these times of charged partisan political feuds.
I've seen some Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere saying that sounds okay, but then you end up with this witch hunt. We're digging, we're fishing for things, whether or not they're related directly to this case. Even if you don't find solid evidence, you can create a bad impression on the public, even if there's nothing really wrong there. Is there a risk of that?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a risk of that. The Ethics in Government Act was allowed to sunset in part because of the Whitewater investigation and the sense among some Democrats that that's what happened in the investigation of Bill Clinton. But, I think if the investigation is circumscribed and really carefully delineated, that there would be a possibility to have this just be an investigation about this one particular issue, look into it, and then, if nothing emerges, then nothing emerges. And then doesn't the administration benefit from that in terms of getting rid of all of these kind of swirling rumors about, their legitimacy and their contacts to Russia?
Let's go back to our callers. Thanks for that call. Patrick is with us now in Evansville. Patrick, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, what I think is, as Attorney General, he was under oath when he was asked about any contact with Russians at any time. And whether it's been proven or not, his opportunity to just recuse himself just seems just a little like what citizen in the United States, if they perjure themselves, it just gets, that's a crime.
Patrick, gotcha, Patrick. Thanks for the call. Rebecca, you were saying you didn't think this rose to the level of perjury, though he was testifying under oath.
I don't. However, I completely understand your listener's viewpoint, at least in one respect, that, he made a statement. His staff had a chance to, so unlike, if you're testifying in court, your staff had a chance to review that statement and supplement it, I would think. The normal practice is his Sessions' staff would have read what he wrote. And so if he had meant to say something else, they would have had a chance to clarify. It does seem odd, not perjury, but it does seem odd that he wouldn't have clarified, yes, I met with the Russian ambassador, but, not in my capacity as a surrogate for the campaign. He could have said that, and that would have just made it clearer. There's lingering concerns that I agree with him. I don't think that it amounts to perjury, but I do think it's concerning from the perspective of any citizen that he should have said that and not have clarified what he meant.
Thanks for that call, Patrick. Victoria is with us next in Duluth, Minnesota. Victoria, hi.
Hi. My comment is that, there seems to be, I definitely think a special independent panel is required to dig into this Russian question. And I guess in light of, the other guy, Flynn, who resigned, and I don't know, there seems to be a whole lot of questions about what kind of contact was happening with the Trump campaign or even now, during the transition. And it seems like there's just a whole lot going on with this Russian question. And I guess as a regular citizen, I'm a little confused about why there's a such a large amount of contact with Russian government officials during the campaign and the transition. Maybe somebody knows there's a reason for that. I can't see it myself.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Rebecca, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think citizens are rightfully concerned, and that's why I think there should be bipartisan interest in clarifying what's been going on, because nothing good comes of this. This is just a blow to the legitimacy of the system. And I know that there is a lot of tension between Democrats and Republicans, but beyond that, there's concern about the democratic structure and systems that we have in place, and they have to be, they have to work. So to me, it seems like there are enough allegations that everybody on both sides of the political fence should want to see this clarified. There just doesn't seem to me to be any incentive not to have some kind of bipartisan effort to look into what actually went on here.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Rebecca Roife, professor of law at the New York Law School, talking about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He's recused himself from any future investigations into potential Russian interference in the United States elections last year. Some calls from Democrats for him to resign over contact he'd had with the Russian ambassador and his answers to questions in his Senate confirmation. Back to our callers now. Ron is on the line in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hello. I just had a question. I'd like to get your thoughts on how this compares to Loretta Lynch's conversation with Bill Clinton and her not recusing herself from an investigation of Hillary. It seems hypocritical that the Democrats are, going after him for this, and there was no outcry from them when the Attorney General at that time had a conversation that obviously Bill claimed was only about their grandchildren, which really, we're supposed to believe that?
Ron, thanks for the call. Yeah, back during the campaign, Hillary Clinton's emails under investigation, then Attorney General, lengthy interaction apparently with Bill Clinton. I believe now Attorney General Sessions had raised criticisms and warnings about that. How does that compare, Rebecca?
I think that's a good point. Loretta Lynch did, in a way, step aside. She decided to defer to top career DOJ officials in their determination of what would be the appropriate reaction to the email investigation. So it's not that she did nothing. The entire branch didn't appoint a special prosecutor, but she did essentially recuse herself from that decision-making process, just to be clear. When she said that I will rely on James Comey's recommendation, what she was saying is I'm not going to make the determination because of the appearance of impropriety. So in some ways, I don't know if there's as much of a hypocrisy as your listener was suggesting. That said, that was a completely, that she should not have had that conversation. And once she had that conversation, I think it was appropriate for her to step aside. Now, should she have done something more, like appointed a special prosecutor under those circumstances? I'm not sure. And that does bring up an important question, which is, there is a cost to appointing a special prosecutor. The cost you suggested, that people think it turns into a witch hunt, but also, this is our elected official. This is the appointed official. There is some democratic accountability here. So it has to be a significant issue to call for a recusal. I definitely think that Sessions' connection to the campaign and now possible connections, with the contact to Russia, is certainly enough to warrant that recusal. Whether or not Loretta Lynch's conversation with Bill Clinton was also, I don't really know, and that really hinges on what was in the content of that conversation, which unfortunately we don't know.
We'll leave it there, Rebecca. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was law professor Rebecca Roife. She joins us to talk about calls for U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from investigations, which he has done, to resign from some, which he has not. More coming up in the news.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we hear the latest installment in our WPR news series on road conditions and road funding in Wisconsin.
And on Food Friday, cooking with cast iron. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.